Welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha, a podcast shared by David Roylance. This podcast is dedicated to guiding you to completely eliminate the discontent mind and the suffering it causes by attaining enlightenment. Learn and practice the teachings of Gautama Buddha that will guide you to fully attain a peaceful, calm, serene, and content mind with joy. To support this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha or visit buddhadailywisdom.com, where you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online learning resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Now, here's our teacher to share more.
Sawadee Kap, hello and welcome to Daily Wisdom, Walking the Path with the Buddha. Today is our Pali Canon and English study group, and we're studying the words of the Buddha. We're in volume 12 of our book series that's titled The Words of the Buddha, The Path to Enlightenment, Revealing the Hidden. We're going to be studying chapters 11 through 20 today. And as I typically do, is I invite people to read the chapter. And if nobody reads, I'll go ahead and read. Then I will share some teachings on that particular chapter and then open up to any and all questions that you guys have related to the teachings of the Buddha. You can ask those questions by putting them into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or if you're in Zoom, you can electronically raise your hand and ask any questions or follow-up questions directly. So I'm going to share these on the screen so that you guys can see them. Oftentimes, students are reading these prior to class, which is an option that you have, that you can read these before class and or after class, and that will actually help you. So here, this first chapter that we're going to be studying today is chapter 11. It's titled, The Perfectly Enlightened One Prohibits Monks from Boasting About a Non-Existence of State of Further Men in Oneself. Whatever monk should speak of a condition of further men, attainment of jhanas or stage of enlightenment, to one who is not ordained, if it is a fact, there is an offense of wrongdoing. So here, this is connected to the teaching that we left off with last week, where the Buddha was talking generally to his students, sharing how it would be unwise to share your attainments of the jhanas or the four stages of enlightenment. And now here, he's talking directly to the monks. The reason why it would be unwise is because it's coming from the arrogance, the boastfulness, the pride, the conceit. The mind is desiring admiration and putting yourself above other people and looking down on them. Going around and claiming that you've attained any particular jhana or any stage of enlightenment would be a really good indication that you haven't attained any of those things. Because in order to get to enlightenment and ultimately purify the mind, you're going to need to eliminate any kind of conceit, which includes arrogance or boastfulness, measuring and comparing others, talking down to people. This is part of the ego. So if an individual is going around boasting about themselves, then this is a clear indication that their mind still has conceit. Oftentimes people will tell you that they are enlightened, but that's a clear indication that their mind is not enlightened, because an enlightened being, their mind is so peaceful and so joyful that they can just go about their day-to-day life being peaceful and joyful. They don't need admiration from others in order to confirm what it is that they're experiencing. They don't need people to bow down to them and treat them any particular way. They can just go about their day with a smile and enjoy the peace and joy of the enlightened mind, because by the time you get to enlightenment, there's nothing that can shake up your mind. Your mind is no longer experiencing any anger, sadness, frustration, irritation, annoyance, guilt, shame, fear, stress, anxiety, loneliness, boredom, shyness, resentment, jealousy, even the slightest displeasure is eliminated from the enlightened mind. There's focus, concentration, clarity, deep memory. Your personal, professional relationships will really blossom. You'll notice that you're not even in a bad mood anymore. So if this is the case, that somebody is enlightened, then they wouldn't need to go around and inform other people that they are enlightened, because there's just no benefit to that. So the Buddha taught that during his life, and it's something that we understand now. Now, of course, the Buddha did share that he was enlightened, but remember that he was an individual who was bringing the teachings into the world. Humanity was largely unaware of what it was that he was having to share in order to help people get to enlightenment. They didn't understand what a Buddha was, so he needed to explain to people that he was a Buddha, he was enlightened. Here's the way to actually accomplish that. But now, 2,500 years later, we understand what enlightenment is. We understand what a Buddha is. We understand how to get to enlightenment. So if you were to go around and boast about being enlightened, that's a clear indication that you're not enlightened. Now, in some situations, you may need to talk with your teacher about your attainments or your stages of enlightenment. And this can actually be really helpful for you because you might be trying to determine which attainment you're in or which stage of enlightenment you're in. And that way it helps you to plot further growth for the future. And if that's the type of conversation that you're having where you're trying to figure out how to continue to move forward on your journey to enlightenment, this isn't the arrogance or boastfulness or pride. This is you trying to sort out your personal development. And you're having that kind of conversation with a teacher. But if you were to have this conversation with your mom or your dad or your brothers or sisters or over a holiday dinner, or if you're posting it on your Facebook page, or you're calling up your mom and like, hey, mom, aren't you so proud of me? I've gotten to the first stage of enlightenment. Well, this is the arrogance, the pride, the boastfulness, and it's really unwise because the more arrogant, the more egotistical you are, people will tend to push you aside. This is what people do in the unenlightened state. When they experience someone who's being arrogant and prideful, they will push you to the side because of their aversion, because they themselves will be having painful feelings, and they think the way to solve that is to push you to the side. Now, if you were arrogant and prideful and boastful around an enlightened being, it wouldn't matter, right? The enlightened being is going to just smile and do whatever they're going to do, however they're going to respond, and responding could be just to ignore it and remain quiet. But in the unenlightened state, unenlightened beings, and the vast majority of the world is unenlightened, when they experience someone who is egotistical or arrogant, they will tend to push that person aside. Not everybody, of course, but a lot of people will. So in addition to the Buddha teaching you how to get to this peaceful, calm, serene, content mind with joy, and you're going to need that in order to get to enlightenment, you're going to need to eliminate the ego, he's teaching you how to reside harmoniously with all beings. You wouldn't be able to reside harmoniously with all beings if you had ego, and you wouldn't be able to experience the peace and joy either. So if you're in this world and you're enlightened, you're still going to be navigating this world with a lot of unenlightened beings in the world. So the Buddha is not only providing you wise decision making about these natural laws of existence and how you can train your mind and gain wisdom to be able to conduct your life with peace and with joy because your mind is peaceful and joyful, but also he's helping you to navigate the world of all these unenlightened beings. And if you are in a world of unenlightened beings, which you are, and you're arrogant and boastful, they're going to push you to the side, and you're going to find that it's very challenging to have personal and professional relationships. So if you tend to notice that people reject you in life and that you don't really kind of fit into some environments, this could be because of the ego. And as you're being arrogant and boastful, people who are into wholesome things will tend to push you to the side. People who are into unwise things or who feed the ego, they might kind of adopt you and bring you in, right? But people who are into wholesome things and can see your ego, they don't like to be talked down to, and they would just prefer not to be around that kind of thing. So by eliminating your ego, not only is your mind going to become more peaceful and joyful, but you're going to be able to live harmoniously and reside harmoniously with all beings around you and navigate this world with more ease, because if you're putting out ego and arrogance, that's what's going to come back to you. So let me know if you guys have any questions on this. You can put this into Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions that you like. Okay, it looks like Mayuli has a question here. What if we discuss with other students, i.e. your mom, trying to determine where you are in the jhanas? Now, talking about the teachings is helpful, right? Like And the Buddha even encouraged this. Like, say you and your mom were talking about the various teachings and you were trying to figure out, like, how can we be practicing right speech here in a better way? Or how can we be practicing this particular thing or that particular thing? This is really helpful. This actually brings the teachings up to the forefront of your mind. And the Buddha encouraged his students to do this because his teachings were all strictly an oral tradition where he would talk orally, and then they would have to remember what he said, and then they would go off and they would discuss it themselves in order to bring the teachings up into the mind and help to clarify them and be able to practice them. So discussing the teachings themselves can be very helpful. But when it comes to discussing your attainments and trying to determine where you are, you and your mother wouldn't really have the background or the wisdom to be able to discern that or figure that out or determine that for yourself or for each other potentially. So that's why it's important to reach out to a teacher to be able to help you, to be able to understand how to determine whether you're in one attainment of the jhanas or another, or you're in one stage of enlightenment or another. So while you and your mother talking back and forth can be very nice, it doesn't really lead to personal growth because both of you guys, I'm figuring, are unenlightened. And in the unenlightened state, an individual has a lot of difficulties to discern where they are in any particular stage of enlightenment. Until you kind of really get further along, your mind has that ego in there, and it's going to want to convince you that you're more enlightened than it really is. And the same thing, like mom might want to think that you're more enlightened than you are, or you might want to think mom's more enlightened than she really is because you guys are maybe seeing each other in a certain way. But when you talk with a teacher, they can walk you through and help you see that more clearly. Because as long as the mind is unenlightened, that means there's certain pollutions that are in the mind. And when you're looking out at the world, it's like looking out through the dirty window. So with ego in your mind, you're looking out through your own eyes at your mom or at yourself with a certain amount of ego. And you can't really wipe that away and be able to see clearly until you've wiped it away, right? So a teacher is going to be there for you to be able to help you and look at your mind objectively and figure out, you know, where are you and what kinds of things do you need to be doing in order to progress forward? And as you're progressing forward, it's really wise to ensure that you never convince yourself that the ego's gone or that you've attained any particular jhana or that you've attained any particular stage of enlightenment. Even though when you're enlightened, you will know, right? Because it'll be 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. You won't be experiencing any discontentedness, and all these qualities that I talk about will be in the mind. You'll know that your mind's enlightened. But it's really wise to never convince yourself of that for various reasons, because the mind can become easily conceitful when you convince yourself that you've attained any particular thing. And as soon as the conceit is arising, that's hindering you from making any further progress. And you're definitely not enlightened if there's conceit. If you convince yourself that you're enlightened, you'll tend to overlook some of the smaller things that your mind's doing that you could actually stamp out and kind of, you know, do what the Buddha describes, which is obliterate it, cut it off at the palm stump, eradicating it from the mind. I talk about wringing out the rag, because as you get to that third stage of enlightenment and you're trying to make your way into the fourth stage, there's just these little tiny little icky situations just for a couple of seconds here and there. And if you convince yourself you're enlightened, you'd miss those and you wouldn't actually take the action that you need in order to eradicate it from the mind. So these are some of the reasons. And also, if one convinces themselves that they're enlightened, or say your mom convinced you that you were in any particular attainment, the mind can become complacent, right? The mind, if it becomes complacent, then for sure it's not yet enlightened. So the mind can oftentimes overlook things because of its own pollution. You're really looking for that outside input, the objective view of a teacher to be able to help you. This is the best way to look inward at the mind and really get some objective feedback to be able to help you continue to progress forward. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions anywhere. I'm just going to check YouTube for a moment. Looks like Wi-Fi is running a little bit slow. We've got Songkran going on here in Thailand, which is a very large holiday. It's a 3 to 5 day holiday. Lots of tourists, lots of Thai people off work. The Wi-Fi is being used quite a bit, the internet. So if my signal's slow on live stream, understand that this is why. Okay, thank you for your question, Mayu Lee. We're going to move on here to chapter 12, which is titled, Do Not Be Judgmental Regarding People. The perfectly enlightened one said to the Venerable Ananda, by reason of the female household practitioner, in a particular name, states disagreement to the fortunate one that her father was celibate, living apart, abstaining from sexual intercourse, but her paternal uncle was not celibate, not abstaining from sexual intercourse, but lived a contented married life. When they died, the fortunate one also declared, they attained to the state of a once returner and have been reborn in the Tesuta group of heavenly beings. Judgmental people compare them, saying, this one has just the same qualities as the other. So, why is one worse and one better? This will be for their lasting harm and suffering. In this case, the person who is sweet-natured and has listened, learned, comprehended, theoretically, and found temporary freedom is better and finer than the other person. Why is that? Because the teaching streams carries him along. But who can know this difference except the Tathagata? Therefore, Ananda, do not be judgmental regarding people. Do not pass judgment on people. Those who pass judgment on people harm themselves. I alone, or one like me, may pass judgment on people. Okay, so what's happening here is there's a particular individual who comes and talks about her father and her father's brother, who was her uncle. And they were both practicing the teachings, and her father became celibate and her uncle was not. He was still in a relationship and having sexual intercourse. And people were trying to measure and compare them of who was better and who was worse and so forth and so on. And the Buddha said, hey, they're both the same. They actually both are once returners, because you can actually continue to have sexual intercourse and be in the second stage of enlightenment because there's still some sensual desire there. So this individual who had eliminated sexual intercourse, they also still had some fetters that were holding on that was keeping them in the second stage of enlightenment too. And the Buddha was noting this, but other people were trying to judge and they were trying to figure out and compare them of what stage of enlightenment they were in and, you know, what was going on in their life and so forth and so on. And the Buddha is saying that judging other people is for your own lasting harm and suffering. That when you look at other people and you judge them and you look down on them, or even you look up to them, because placing yourself above people and looking down on them, that's just as dangerous as also putting yourself below people. When you put yourself below people and you look up to them with such admiration and you think that you're diminished and you're diminishing yourself with negative self-talk, this is just as damaging to your mind. So when you're judgmental and you're trying to measure and compare people, this is harming yourself and it's causing yourself discontentedness. Where the judgment comes in is that in our animal existences, we needed conceit. We needed a pecking order. We needed to know in our wolf pack who was the alpha male and alpha female, because they were teaching us how to hunt and how to survive. Our matriarch of our elephant herd, she was showing us where to eat. She was showing us the watering holes, the migration paths, things like this. We needed to know who's the top of our elephant herd. And we had this pecking order in the elephant herd. And the same thing in a group of monkeys or any other types of animals, they will tend to have a certain pecking order. And this is needed in order for survival in the animal realm. But because we've all been reborn countless times and our mind has been conditioned from all these different animal existences, and now we're in this human realm as a human being, the consciousness is still holding on to conditioning from the animal realm. And therefore, this pecking order and this conceit that's in there, it holds on. And now in the human realm, an individual might be trying to measure and compare and try to figure out, where am I amongst this group of people? And now when you go into a social situation, you might have a really hard time because you're trying to kind of measure and compare people and figure out who you're above and who you're below. And when you're around one group of people, you talk down to those people. But when you're with another group of people, you talk up to those people with such admiration. But this is actually causing the mind to be obsessive, because if you're in this group of people, you're having to constantly figure out, who am I above and who am I below? Who do I talk down to and who do I talk up to? What you're looking to get to is a permanent practice where you can just treat all beings equally. Whether you're talking to the president of your country or you're talking to someone who's sweeping the street outside, you would like to be just as polite, kind, friendly, and respectful, because then you can get to a permanent practice that you just treat everybody the same and your mind can be at ease, that you're not trying to constantly figure out this pecking order and your mind doesn't have to be obsessive about that. And also, if you're judging other people, you will tend to judge yourself too, and you'll have negative self-talk in your own mind. So when you learn how to eliminate your judgment towards others, you can eliminate your judgment towards yourself and start to work on eliminating that negative self-talk. And this is what the Buddha is explaining, that by you judging other people, you're actually harming yourself. You're suffering yourself, because when you judge other people, you're going to judge yourself, you're going to diminish yourself, you're going to degrade yourself, and this is really unhelpful for the mind. So here the Buddha is basically saying, you know, Ananda, which is his closest student, Don't be judgmental regarding people. Don't pass judgment on others, right? Don't look at other people and try to figure out where are they. It's all about your practice. That's what this journey to enlightenment is about. It's not about looking at other people and saying, oh, they don't eat vegan, and oh, they do this and they do that, and I'm better than them, and I'm further along on the path than they are. That's not what this path is about. It's about your own individual development, your own individual growth. So the Buddha is saying, don't pass judgment on people. Don't look at other people and try to measure and compare them. But what the Buddha is saying is he's saying he himself or one like him, meaning a Buddha, is able to look at another person and determine whether or not they're in any particular stage of enlightenment or not. The Buddha is not talking down to people and he's not talking up to people, but he has the ability to determine what is wise or unwise, what is wholesome or what is unwholesome. And an individual who is a Buddha is able to look at others and be able to accomplish that. Where an individual who's not a Buddha wouldn't be able to accomplish that because the mind's judging. The only reason why a Buddha would look at a student and help them or understand what's going on in their mind is because it's actually helping them to get to enlightenment. That if this student that's studying with a Buddha is having arrogance or conceit, or say they're having sensual desire or ill will, or say they're having personal existence view, or any of these other fetters that we talk about from time to time, a Buddha can observe those as somebody's interacting in the world. They can observe that person interacting through those fetters and through that pollution. So a Buddha can know, oh, this person's in the first stage of enlightenment, or oh, this person's in the jhanas, or oh, this person isn't even in the jhanas. And then as part of studying with a Buddha, that individual would then help you to then be able to progress along the path. So that's the only reason why a Buddha does this, but they're not looking down on people. Right, when we use this word judgment. So when you look here in the book and you look at all the various resources that I share what is judgment and I share what is discernment, because people oftentimes confuse these. What judgment is where you're looking at another person and you're attempting to determine what's right or wrong for that person and placing yourself above them or below them. You're kind of comparing yourself. You're thinking you're either superior or inferior to another person, attempting to declare what is wholesome or unwholesome or good or bad. Any kind of judgment is coming from conceit. And this is very harmful to the mind and it needs to be eliminated in order to get to enlightenment. But discernment is something that you need. You actually need to cultivate this in order to get to enlightenment. What discernment is wise decision making. So sometimes people get confused and they think, if I make a decision to do something, this is a judgment. Or if I choose a white shirt over a black shirt, that's a judgment. That's not a judgment. That's a decision, right? You're just making a decision about whether I should have a white shirt or a blue shirt or what I should be wearing, right? That's what a decision is, or discernment. Discernment is specifically wise decision making. So there's decision making, there's wise decision making, which is discernment, but then there's judgment. Judgment is looking down on others and trying to determine what is wholesome or unwholesome for other people. And this would be very unwise. You're going to need to eliminate any kind of judgment towards others or towards yourself. Where discernment, you're going to need to cultivate that in the mind. So let me know what questions you guys have on this chapter, chapter 12. This is do not be judgmental regarding people. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions here. So I'm going to move on to chapter 13. There we go. Chapter 13 is titled The Five Great Thieves. Monks, there are these five great thieves to be found in the world. What are the five? 1. Monks, hear a certain one of the great thieves thought, to be sure, will I, surrounded by 100 or by 1,000, wander about among villages, towns, in the possessions of kings, slaying and causing to be slain, destroying and causing destruction, tormenting and causing torment. He, in the course of time, surrounded by 100 or by 1,000, wanders about among villages, towns, in the possessions of kings, slaying and causing to be slain, destroying and causing destruction, tormenting and causing torment. Now, indeed, monks, a certain unwholesome monk thought, To be sure, I, surrounded by 100 or by 1,000, will make an alms tour among villages, towns, and the possessions of kings, honored, respected, appreciated, worshipped, admired, supported by householders, by those who have gone forth into homelessness, and by the requisites of robes, alms food, bedding, and medicine. He, in the course of time, surrounded by 100, by 1,000, made an alms tour among villages, towns, and the possessions of kings, honored, respected, appreciated, worshipped, admired, supported by householders, and receiving the requisites of robes, alms food, bedding, and medicine for those who go forth into homelessness. This monks is the first great thief found existing in the world. Again, monks, here a certain unwholesome monk, having mastered thoroughly teachings and the discipline made known by the Tathagata, takes it for his own. This, monks, is the second great thief found existing in the world. 3. Again, monks, here a certain unwholesome monk blames a follower of the pure Brahma life, one leading the absolutely pure Brahma life, for an unfounded breach of the Brahma life. This, monks, is the third great thief found existing in the world. 4. Again, monks, a certain unwholesome monk favors and persuades a householder on account of those things which are important, possessions of the community, on account of those things which are its important requisites. That is to say, a park, a site for a park, a vihara or monastery, a site for a vihara, a couch, a chair, a bolster, a pillow, a brass vessel, a brass jar, a brass pot, a brass receptacle, a razor, an axe, a hatchet, a hoe, a spade, a creeper, bamboo, munja grass, babaja grass, tina grass, clay, wooden articles, earthenware articles. This, monks, is the fourth great thief found existing in the world. 5. Monks, in the world, with the heavenly beings, and including Mara, including the Brahma world, including aesthetics and Brahmins, including breathing things, including heavenly beings and men, this is the chief great thief, he who claims a non-existent state of further men, which is enlightenment, which has not been attained. What is the reason for this? Monks, you have eaten the country's alms food by theft. Okay, so I'm going to focus in on a few things here that the Buddha is describing. The second one, I'll focus in on this, that the Buddha is describing that somebody who learns his teachings and then they take those teachings and go out into the world and now claim them as their own and share them as if they are their own teachings rather than attributing it to the Buddha says this is a thief, that somebody has stolen the teachings and now they go out into the world claiming that it's their own. Well, the teachings of the Buddha don't really belong to the Buddha. They don't belong to me. They don't belong to anybody. These are teachings that are part of humanity. But it's wise that when you're learning teachings and you go out into the world and you start sharing those teachings, that you acknowledge where they came from. It's just like if you were to do a research paper in a college course, if you were to plagiarize, if you were to take other people's research and then submit it as your own, this is plagiarism. And now you're going to lose your reputation because people are going to discover that you haven't been honest about where you sourced your materials and you're presenting something as your own, but yet it belongs to somebody else. So here the Buddha is saying essentially the same thing, that people are plagiarizing him, that they're taking his teachings. And this occurred during his lifetime. It even occurs now. I've seen this occur where people will maybe learn from me for 6 months or a year or something like that. They'll learn a few things and then they'll go off and they'll start sharing those things as if they are their own teachings, not even giving the Buddha credit for these teachings whatsoever. And this is very unwise. And this is from the conceit. This is the arrogance, the pride, putting oneself above others, rather than just acknowledging that these teachings came from somebody else. It's the mind wanting to take ownership and claim ownership of these for themselves. And this is very unwise. The third one that the Buddha is talking about here is an individual who's looking at another person and trying to declare what's wholesome and unwholesome for them. And the Buddha is specifically talking about Brahmin here, that there's a particular unwholesome monk who's looking at Brahmin, who the Brahmin are Hindu priests, and trying to determine where they are having shortcomings in their life practice. And this is very unwise. And the Buddha is describing this person as a thief as well. And then ultimately he gets down here where he talks about how if an individual basically is claiming to be enlightened, and yet they haven't actually attained enlightenment, this is also a thief as well. And the Buddha is saying that you're essentially eating the country's alms food by theft. And the reason why is because as an ordained practitioner, if you're going around collecting donations of food, clothing, shelter, medical care, even financial support nowadays, your goal is to use that to help you to cultivate wisdom and get closer and closer to enlightenment, that you don't have to go to work each day, you don't have to worry about clothing and rent and all these other things, that you can just get deeper, deeper, and deeper into your practice. And then as a result of that, that the gamma is that your students and the community have supported you with clothing, food, water, shelter, and things like this, that now as you have gotten more and more wise, you would like to then share that wisdom back with the community so that the household practitioners can learn and grow and develop, and they can get closer and closer to enlightenment themselves. That's the whole role of an ordained practitioner or a teacher like me that is accepting donations, is that we kind of unplug from worldly life in terms of going to a particular career or things like that, so that as an individual gets closer and closer to enlightenment themselves, then they can help others to accomplish the same thing. But if someone's going around boasting that they're enlightened and they're not even enlightened, which is what the Buddha is describing here, the Buddha is saying, okay, you're a thief, that you're just stealing the donations from the community because you're not doing the actual work to get rid of your conceit and now actually help them by sharing teachings. You're just interested in going around and being boastful and arrogant about what you may or may not have attained. And this is very unwise. Instead, just focus on your own growth, your own development. No need to boast about it to anybody else. If you're an ordained practitioner or a teacher and you're accepting donations, no reason to boast about what it is that you've attained. As soon as your mind does that, it's hindering you from getting to enlightenment, because an enlightened being isn't going to be boastful. They're not even going to share with other people that they're enlightened. They don't need to. They're just going to go enjoy that peaceful and joyful mind. There's no reason to go out and look for admiration from other people. Your mind's so peaceful and joyful. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this particular chapter. This is chapter 13 in volume 12. It's titled The Five Great Thieves. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. So let's go to chapter 14. Now, chapter 14 in this book, it's a chapter that I reference frequently when I'm teaching all the foundational classes. As I teach like foundational courses and retreats, I teach the Eightfold Path, which is the core central teaching. And when I teach Right Livelihood there, I teach the first fold of purification, but there's a second fold of purification. And I tend to guide people to volume 12, chapter 14, and I let people know that this is the place. If they're in a current job that you don't particularly like and you would like to move to something new, or say you're unemployed and you're looking to acquire a new job or something like that, or maybe you're looking to acquire your very first job perhaps, this is a great chapter for you, because this is a consolidated place where all the teachings around Right Livelihood come together, where you can see the first fold of purification and the second fold of purification. And it's not until you have that second fold of purification that your livelihood is fully purified and your mind would be able to attain enlightenment. In that first fold of purification, there's certain benefits that you're experiencing there, but you wouldn't actually be able to attain enlightenment. So here I'm going to walk you through helping you understand this first fold of purification and the second fold, because this is what you would need to be able to accomplish in order to actually get to enlightenment. This one is titled A Noble Disciple Abandons Wrong Livelihood. Therein, monks, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong livelihood as wrong livelihood, and right livelihood as right livelihood. This is one's right view. And what, monks, is wrong livelihood? Scheming, flattery, hinting, belittling, pursuing gain with gain. This is wrong livelihood. And what, monks, is right livelihood? Right livelihood, I say, is twofold. There is right livelihood that is affected by the taints or fetters, taking part in merit, ripening in the material gain. And there is right livelihood that is noble, taintless, world transcending, a factor of the path. Okay, so right here, the Buddha is describing that in order to do your livelihood, you would need to ensure that you're not scheming, flattering, hinting, which is like being unclear with your speech during your livelihood and as you're doing any kind of professional things, belittling, which is like talking down about your competition or your business partners or your colleagues, pursuing gain with gain, which is like just chasing after a paycheck, just chasing after money. That's all you care about. You don't care about the product or the service that you're providing. It's really not about that for you. If you're pursuing gain with gain, it's just about making money. And that's going to burn out, because essentially what you're going to get to when you fully purify your livelihood is that you thoroughly enjoy the work that you do. You have motivation, ambition, that you're have enthusiasm, that it doesn't even feel like work anymore. That whatever occupation that you're doing or however you're choosing to support yourself, that even if you didn't get paid for it, you would still do it. You just enjoy it that much. But if you're pursuing gain with gain, where you're just pursuing things for money, eventually that craving is going to burn out. And now you're going to be left with a job that you don't particularly care about. And you're in a career that you don't particularly care about. And now you're going to find it very challenging to sustain your life. And at the very least, you're going to go to work every day unmotivated, dragging yourself to work. So the first part of getting to a right livelihood is to ensure you're not scheming, which is corruption. You're not flattering, which is insincere comments just to get people to buy things from you. Hinting, which is being unclear about your work and your communication while you're at work. Belittling, which is degrading and diminishing others. Or pursuing gain with gain, which is pursuing things just for craving out of wanting wealth. Well, there's that aspect to it. And then there's other teachings where the Buddha teaches you about ensuring that you're not selling weapons, living beings, meat, substances that cause heedlessness, and poisons. You'll see this when I teach right livelihood as part of the Eightfold Path, because all of these livelihoods are actually causing harm to other beings. So therefore, harm is going to come to you as a result. And you can independently verify and reflect these to be able to see that this is the truth. So here, that first fold of purification is ensuring that you're not practicing one of the first five of business and weapons, living beings, meat, substances that cause heedlessness and poisons, and that you're not scheming, flattering, hinting, belittling, pursuing gain with gain. This is wrong livelihood. So this is the first level of purification. And that's what the Buddha is saying here, is that there's these two fold of purification for right livelihood, which the first fold is affected by the taints, meaning your pollutions of mind, your fetters, are still affecting you, that you haven't fully purified your mind yet, and whatever livelihood you're practicing isn't yet maybe fully your right livelihood, because you're still making decisions in your livelihood based on these taints or these pollutions. But it does take part in merit, meaning that you're acquiring a certain amount of income and you're practicing generosity to help the continuation of the teachings of the Buddha to be able to be shared in the world, that you are helping the teachings in one way or another, and you're using your righteously gained income to be able to help you to accomplish that. And then ripening in material gain, meaning that you're gaining a certain amount of material wealth as part of that livelihood, right? So that's the first fold of purification. But then there's a second fold of purification of right livelihood that is noble, taintless, world transcending, a factor of the path. This is where you're in a livelihood where it's not affected by the fetters, that you're not making decisions based on the pollutions of mind. And now the Buddha is going to kind of give you some details on this and help you see this and broken down a bit more. He says, in what monks is right livelihood that is affected by taints, taking part in merit, ripening in the material gain? Here, monks, a noble disciple abandons wrong livelihood and gains his living by right livelihood. This is right livelihood that is affected by taints, taking part in merit, ripening in the material gain. And what, monks, is right livelihood that is noble, taintless, world transcending, a factor of the path? The desisting from wrong livelihood, the abstaining, refraining, withholding from it, in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, whose possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right livelihood that is noble, taintless, world-transcending, a factor of the path. Okay, so let me explain to you about this before we go on further. So you could have an individual, or you could be an individual, who might be working in a certain livelihood, and you've chosen that livelihood at some particular time. But then as you have chosen that livelihood, you could have, for example, arrogance or conceit. The ego could be involved in selecting that livelihood. But then as you make your way closer and closer to enlightenment and you're stripping away the ego, you might realize that that livelihood that you're in is unwise and that you'd rather switch to something else. And now you feel comfortable doing that because that conceit and ego and arrogance isn't there anymore. And now you might switch to something else that's more in line with your particular interest, and that's going to have motivation and ambition and enthusiasm as you practice this particular livelihood. So let me give you a tangible example. Say if I was 20 years old or 22 years old, I'm very interested in helping people, and I'm very interested in being a police officer, and I would like to go out and be this police officer. And I go out and I do all the training and all the jumping jacks and sit-ups and everything that they do, and I get my uniform, I get my badge, I'm so proud of this, I wear it proudly, and I go out into the community, and now I'm doing certain things that I need to do as a police officer. Maybe I'm hitting people. Maybe I'm throwing people up against the wall. Maybe I'm locking them up with handcuffs. Maybe I'm doing other different types of things, of course. Of course, police officers do more than just that. But just say, for example, I'm doing some of those things. And maybe my ego was involved here, right? The conceit, the arrogance. And that's why I chose to select this particular livelihood as a police officer. Well, at the core of this is that I really was interested in helping people. But because the ego was in there, it drove me towards being a police officer, right? But now maybe somebody got on the path to enlightenment. Maybe they're meditating. Maybe they're stripping away some of these fetters. And as they start stripping away some of these fetters, they realize that what's at the core of what they're really interested in doing is helping people. And throwing people up against the car and up against the wall just doesn't match to what it is that they're interested in doing any longer. So as they stripped away this ego and they realize the harm that they're causing through that particular aspect of their job, they decide to switch to something else that is more in line with helping people. So maybe now they decide to be a social worker or a therapist or something like this, where they could actually help people and get in touch with that initial ambition and enthusiasm that they had to help people. But earlier in their development, before they were actually on the path, there was conceit and arrogance and pride there. So that's why they went towards being a police officer. But now that they stripped away that conceit, now they're moving towards something else. And this isn't to say that every police officer has ego. That's not true at all. You know, there's some people who are police officers that this is their right livelihood. This is their fully purified livelihood, right? But I'm just giving you this example because I think it's one that you can probably relate to, right? So here, the Buddha is describing these two different types of livelihoods. One is where the taints or the fetters are still involved in any of the choices that you're making. And two, the second one is where you've stripped all that away and you're no longer making decisions through the fetters. And you could potentially experience that as you're moving closer and closer to enlightenment. Some people, when they come to the path, they are kind of up in arms about their livelihood and not quite sure what they're going to do in order to sustain their life. Other people, they're locked in. Like, they've already picked a right livelihood before they ever even came to the path to enlightenment. I've talked with brand new students before that absolutely thoroughly enjoy the work that they're doing. They've been doing it for 10, 15, 20 years. They'll never switch to anything else any longer because they just thoroughly enjoy the work that they're doing, and they would do it at no cost if they were able to. But of course, they need to select a paycheck. So some people are already doing a particular livelihood that they feel very enthused about when they actually come to the path to enlightenment. They might have that one purified fully. But now the Buddha goes on, and as he's describing these two different aspects of right livelihood, he says, one makes an effort to abandon wrong livelihood and to enter upon right livelihood. This is one's right effort, right? Because right effort is to eliminate unwholesome and arise the wholesome. Mindfully, one abandons wrong livelihood. Mindfully, one enters upon and resides in right livelihood. This is one's right mindfulness. Well, you need right mindfulness in order to practice right effort. You need to be aware of what's going on in your mind to be able to see how you feel about any particular job. Whatever you're choosing to do, if you're having difficulties in your career, it's not the outside world, right? Like, you need to be able to see and clarify and purify your mind and get to the point where you can see that it's not your boss that is annoying you, right? It's not your coworkers that are frustrating you. It's your own mind having craving, desire, attachment. But you still might need to switch certain livelihood. But as you might choose to do that, you still need to practice all these other factors of the path to purify your mind of any cravings, desires, attachments. And the Buddha is explaining to you here that right mindfulness and right effort are key to be able to help you with that. And at the beginning, he talks about right view, because you need right view in your work environment. What right view is all about is the Four Noble Truths, of where you learn the problem in the unenlightened mind, the cause of that problem, the elimination of it, and the path forward. So if you have established right view, then you understand that your own mind is causing your anger, your sadness, your frustration, and other discontent feelings. So if you enter into a work environment with right view, then anytime your mind is annoyed or frustrated or agitated, you know it's coming from your own mind. So that's why the Buddha here is explaining that in order to get to a fully purified right livelihood, you're going to need right view to be on board first. And then you're also going to need right mindfulness to be aware of your mind while you're at work. And you're going to need to apply right effort, to apply the effort in your actual job or occupation or your livelihood. So now the Buddha's tying all this together. He says, thus, these three states run in circle around right livelihood. That is right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, right? So that's what's going to help you to accomplish right livelihood. You wouldn't be able to get to a right livelihood without a right view, right effort, and right mindfulness well developed. All these factors are working together to support each other. Therein, monks, right view comes first, right? So this is why I always teach right view first. When a student's typically starting with me from the very beginning, I will teach them the Four Noble Truths from the very beginning, because that comes first, not just in order to accomplish right livelihood, but any aspect of the path. An individual needs to establish right view. And how does right view come first? In one of right view, right intention comes into being. In one of right intention, right speech comes into being. In one of right speech, right action comes into being. In one of right action, right livelihood comes into being. In one of right livelihood, right effort comes into being. In one of right effort, right mindfulness comes into being. In one of right mindfulness, right concentration comes into being. In one of right concentration, right wisdom comes into being. In one of right wisdom, right liberation comes into being. So what he's essentially saying here is that these are all supporting each other. You don't master one in order to get to the other. You're actually dialing all of these in simultaneously. And here, the Buddha is actually pointing to the tenfold path, right? He says here at the end, he says, thus, monks, the path of the disciple in higher training possesses eight factors. The arahant possesses 10 factors. This is the tenfold path. So as you're making your way to enlightenment, you need the eightfold path. That's what you're learning. That's what you're developing. That's what you're understanding. That's what's going to lead you to enlightenment. But by the time you get to enlightenment, you will be practicing the tenfold path. You don't usually hear much about this, but I'll share it with you. What the tenfold path is you're adding two extra factors, the right wisdom and the right liberation. The Buddha doesn't teach you exactly what these are, because it's a culmination of the Eightfold Path and all of his other teachings coming together. So with something like right intention, for example, there's three aspects of right intention: the intention of renunciation, the intention of non-ill will, the intention of harmlessness. Something like right speech, there is the refraining from lying, slander, harsh speech, and frivolous speech, right? There are certain aspects of these that you can understand and you can learn, reflect on, and practice. But with right wisdom and right liberation, these are things that you have developed in your journey to enlightenment. What right wisdom is that you have fully cultivated all the wisdom that it takes to get to enlightenment. This is also referred to as final knowledge, that by the time you have gotten to enlightenment, you will be practicing right wisdom, meaning the wisdom of the path to enlightenment is deeply soaked into your mind. And you could discuss this with ease with anybody. Like, say you're at a bus stop and somebody's like, hey, you practice the Buddhist teachings. What is right speech all about? You'd easily be able to say, oh, that's refraining from lying, slander, harsh speech, and frivolous speech. because you will have learned it so deeply, you would have reflected on all of those things, and you would have dialed that into your life closer and closer in your practice, that it's just imprinted in your mind. You just understand it so clearly. So right wisdom is a culmination of all your growth and all your development on the path to enlightenment, where you understand the path to enlightenment very clearly and very deeply, and you'd be able to speak about it with ease. You might not choose to be a teacher or anything like that, but if somebody asked you a question about any aspect of the path to enlightenment, you'd be able to easily answer it because this is wisdom that you have on board. It's like upgrading your operating system of your computer, that it's just there, it's just present. It's just so easy for you to access because you're practicing it day in and day out effortlessly. And then what right liberation is, which is the 10th factor of the tenfold path, this is where the mind is actually liberated. It's free from strong feelings. There's no longer any discontent feelings. The mind is now actually enlightened. And this is a result of having put together all the other factors. You wouldn't be able to get to right wisdom and right liberation without the Eightfold Path. So that's why people focus on the Eightfold Path, because by putting all that together, it leads to right wisdom and right liberation, where your mind's actually no longer experiencing discontent feelings. So this is what right wisdom and what right liberation is, and it's only an enlightened being that's actually practicing that to perfection, because they've allowed that to deeply soak into the mind through their dedication, determination, and diligence, and now they just have it easily accessible in their mind to be able to explain it so easily. So that's what the Buddha is referring to here, is that it's these 10 factors that leads to a fully purified mind, and ultimately you're going to need to purify your livelihood. So therein, monks, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? In one of right view, wrong view is abolished, and the many evil unwholesome states that originate with wrong view as condition are also abolished. In the many unwholesome states that originate with right view as condition come to fulfillment by development. In one of right intention, wrong intention is abolished. In the many evil unwholesome states that originate with wrong intention as condition are also abolished. In the many wholesome states that originate with right intention as condition come to fulfillment by development. In one of right speech, wrong speech is abolished. In one of right action, wrong action is abolished. In one of right livelihood, wrong livelihood is abolished. In one of right effort, wrong effort is abolished. In one of right mindfulness, wrong mindfulness is abolished. In one of right concentration, wrong concentration is abolished. In one of right wisdom, wrong wisdom is abolished. In one of right liberation, wrong liberation is abolished. In the many evil unwholesome states that originate with wrong liberation as condition are also abolished. And the many wholesome states that originate with right liberation as condition come to fulfillment by development. Thus, monks, there are 20 factors on the side of the wholesome and 20 factors on the side of the unwholesome. This teaching's discourse on the Great 40 has been set rolling and cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin, or God or Mara, or Brahma, or anyone in the world. Okay, I'm gonna pause here for a moment and help you understand what the Buddha's sharing. What he's sharing is that it's this tenfold path that he's shared that has now entered into the world, and as more and more and more and more people understand that deeply, there's nobody that can stop those teachings from going forward. Because once somebody understands the truth and they see the truth in the teachings of the Buddha, they're not going to stop sharing those teachings. That if you get to enlightenment and your mind understands what it takes to be able to get to enlightenment, it's very easy for you to be able to see the difference between the unenlightened mind and the enlightened mind. And that enlightened mind is so wonderful for anybody to have experienced, that now if anybody is interested in help with that path to enlightenment, they would be able to then share a bit of teachings with them to be able to help them. And the Buddha is saying that nobody's going to stop this, because it's just going to spread like wildfire all over the world, is essentially what he's sharing here. Monks, if any ascetic or Brahmin thinks that this teaching discourse on the Great 40 should be criticized and rejected, then there are 10 legitimate deductions from his assertions that would prove grounds for finding fault with him here and now. If that worthy one finds fault with right view, then he would honor and praise those ascetics and Brahmins who are of wrong view. If that worthy one finds fault with right intention, then he would honor and praise those ascetics and Brahmins who are of wrong intention. So he just goes on through all of these: wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, wrong concentration, wrong wisdom, and wrong liberation. So what he's saying is, if somebody looks at his teachings and they find fault in the tenfold path, then they must honor and respect people who are doing unwise things, right? If somebody's into unwholesomeness, when they see wholesome teachings, they're like, no, you know, that's not the way to be. Like, you've got to have ego. You've got to have arrogance. Like, you can't live without arrogance and ego. Like, you've got to go out into the world. People are going to walk all over you if you don't have ego. Don't eliminate the ego, right? This is what somebody might say, right? But for somebody who's into wholesome things and they understand these teachings, they wouldn't say those kinds of things because they understand how unwise it is to have ego. But for someone who finds fault in these teachings, they would honor and praise others who are doing unwise things. That's what the Buddha is saying. Essentially, the darkness is attracted to the darkness. The people who are in the light are attracted to the people who are in the light. That's what the Buddha is essentially saying here. If any ascetics or Brahmins think that this teaching's discourse on the Great 40 should be criticized and rejected, then these are 10 legitimate deductions from his assertions that would prove grounds for finding fault with him here and now. Monks, even those teachers from Ocala, Vasa, and Bana, who held the doctrine of non-causality, the doctrine of non-action, and the doctrine of nihilism, would not think that this discourse of the teachings on the Great 40 should be criticized and rejected. Why is that? For fear of blame, attack, and evidence that they are incorrect. So what he's saying here is, any teachers, and he names three of them here that existed during his lifetime, that are teaching that there's no such thing as the natural law of karma. That's what it means to be teaching a doctrine of non-causality. That means, like, there's no such thing as cause and effect, that any decision you make, you're not going to experience the results of that. Or a doctrine of non-action, it's the same thing. It's like saying that there's no such thing as cause and effect or action and result. So someone who's teaching that when you make a decision, that there is no reaction or there is no effect, of course, this isn't the truth, but people were teaching that during the lifetime of the Buddha, and people are teaching that now. The Buddha is saying even those people aren't going to reject the tenfold path. And the reason why is because they fear blame, attack, and evidence that they are incorrect. Because when you look at the detail of the tenfold path and what the Buddha has actually laid down, you can see very clearly that it's the truth. And if you practice it close enough, you'll be able to see it through the condition of your mind and the condition of your life improving. So this is the teaching here that the Buddha is describing. I also have a bunch of words here to be able to help you to understand what the Buddha is teaching on right livelihood. This is going to fully flesh it out for you so that you can fully understand what it is that the Buddha taught. I go through each individual aspect of this discourse thoroughly and in detail. So if you're ever interested in changing jobs, or if you're looking for a new job, this would be really good to read a few times to refresh your memory. You can see there's a lot of content here to be able to help you. And then as you need help and you need clarification, just reach out to me and I'll be here to help you to gain some clarity on this. So it looks like Keely has a question. If anyone else has a question, you guys are welcome to ask through Facebook, YouTube, or Zoom. Or in Zoom, you can raise your hand electronically and ask any questions that you like. Go ahead, Keely.
Yeah, David, the Buddha said if ordained practitioners provide tattoos, palm reading spells, predictions based on astronomy, etc., they will be considered practicing wrong livelihood. My question is, how about household practitioners? If they do this kind of occupation, would they consider to be wrong livelihood or right livelihood?
It depends on why they're doing it, right? It's not just about the occupation itself. So let's just take someone who's a tattoo artist, for example, right? In this situation, this person's an artist. If somebody was doing it just for money and that's all they cared about, it wouldn't be a right livelihood, right? Because they're just pursuing gain with gain. But there could be somebody else who's doing it for real, true reasons. So each individual is going to be different. You can't just pick a particular livelihood, except for some, like ones that are like weapons or living beings, meat, substances that cause heedlessness and poisons. Those are the ones that you can say, yes, these are absolutely wrong livelihoods. But some of the ones that you mentioned, and I didn't try to remember all the ones you mentioned, but those could potentially be a wrong livelihood or potentially not. If they're not one of those five and the individual is not practicing any of these things, then they've got the first fold of purification. And then if they've chosen that livelihood without the fetters being involved, then this is a fully purified livelihood. But for each individual, that's different. It's not going to be based on just the occupation itself.
Okay, got it. Thank you, David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're welcome. Great question. Okay. So let's see. Looks like Mayuli has a question as well. For a second fold livelihood, what if you still need some money to sustain your life? Is there some cravings there? So you can get to a second fold of livelihood and still be making money. The problem isn't making money. Like pursuing gain with gain, that's where all you care about is the money, right? So I'll give you an example. Like when I was in America, I opened up two Thai massage centers and a school, and I thoroughly enjoyed the work that I was doing. There was quite a bit of money that I was making as part of that, but I thoroughly enjoyed the work, and I was doing it because I really enjoyed helping people. The money was like secondary, right? It was almost like sometimes when the money was coming in, it was just like, gosh, I don't even need this. I just am interested in helping people. And in some cases, I gave away classes for free. In some cases, I did massages for free because I knew people needed the work or they needed the class and they didn't have the income to support it. So I wasn't interested in making money. It was all about helping people, but we needed to make a certain amount of money. So you can make money and still be having a fully purified livelihood. So that's not the issue. What the issue is when you're longing and yearning for it, right? Like you can acquire money. It's not that you have to give up money and walk around without any money. That's not practical. It's that you need to ensure that you're not basing your inner feelings on the money. So for example, if your bank account is this, you're so happy, you're so excited. But when it goes down, then you're sad or frustrated. Or you get a promotion at work. You get so excited, you're jumping for joy because you're so excited because you got more money. That's the craving, desire, attachment. The longing, the yearning is producing those pleasant feelings. But now when the company comes to you and says, hey, we're going through hard financial times, we need to lay you off, or we need to reduce your schedule to a 3-day work a week, and now we're going to reduce your salary. Now you're going to be sad or frustrated or upset. So the craving, desire, attachment is inside the mind longing, yearning. It's not the money itself. It's not the object. So you're still able to make money. You can actually be quite rich and quite wealthy and be enlightened at the same time, but it's all about how you acquire that money. It's all about how you think about that money, and it's all about what you do with the money once you have it. That's what's going to determine whether there's a craving, desire, attachment in the mind, whether there's this longing and yearning. So it's all about how you acquire it. It's all about what you do with it. It's all about how you think about this money, those kinds of things. That's what's going to determine whether there's a craving. And if you're basing your inner feelings on the money, that's the craving, desire, attachment that's causing that to occur. So there can be people who are very rich and very wealthy, and it's just like, yeah, I've created these companies, I've make all this money, but yeah, it doesn't really, I don't form my inner feelings on these things. And they may even be doing a lot of charity work, right? The for-profit money that they might be doing might be funding their charity work and their community outreach and things like that. Because I know I used to do a lot of that when I was in America. So you can think about those things and let me know if you have any questions on that. Okay, so let's move to the next chapter. I'm not seeing any other questions anywhere. So this is a great chapter for you to read if you're looking for a new job or you're looking to change jobs, as I mentioned. Spend some good time with that chapter. This next one, chapter 15, this one's titled Six Cases of Incapability by One Accomplished in View, First Discourse. So these are the discourses that I talk about when I teach the retreat in January. Each year I teach a retreat that is helping you to be able to get to the first stage of enlightenment. It's all the teachings you need to get to the first stage of enlightenment. So in order to get on the path to enlightenment, you need to establish right view, right? But then to get to the first stage of enlightenment, you need to do what's called accomplishment in view, where you've already established right view through the Four Noble Truths, but then you have developed accomplishment in view, which is an extended part of developing right view. And here you're going to see a series of four discourses where the Buddha is explaining how to develop accomplishment in view. So you would need to be practicing all of these things in order to then develop accomplishment in view. And it's part of getting to the first stage of enlightenment. It's not everything you need, but it's part of it. So here I'll read these. Monks, there are these six cases of incapability. What six? One accomplished in view is, one, incapable of considering any conditioned phenomenon or thing as permanent. Two, incapable of considering any conditioned phenomenon, thing as pleasurable. Three, incapable of considering any phenomenon, thing as a self. Four, incapable of doing a grave act that brings immediate results. Five, incapable of resorting to the belief that purity, enlightenment, comes about through superstitious and auspicious acts. Six, incapable of seeking a person worthy of offerings outside of here. These are the six cases of incapability. Okay, so let me walk you guys through this. So what the Buddha is saying here is that by the time you have accomplishment in view, you would be incapable of determining that any conditioned object is permanent, that you would have looked around the world and you would have clearly been able to understand the universal truth of impermanence, and you understand that everything around you is impermanent. Anything you see, hear, smell, taste, anything that comes in contact with the body, or any thoughts or ideas that go through the mind, anything you experience through the six sense bases is all impermanent, right? So the only things that I found that are permanent are enlightenment itself and the natural laws of existence, because these are unconditioned objects. But what the Buddha is describing here is that you won't be able to consider any conditioned object as permanent, that you would deeply understand the universal truth of impermanence. Here he says, incapable of considering any conditioned phenomenon or any conditioned object as pleasurable. What he's talking about here is that you wouldn't be forming your inner feelings based on this object, right? That you understand in your own mind that you're not just forming your inner feelings, because at this point, by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you still do have sensual desire. But what he's basically saying is that you would be incapable of thinking or considering a particular conditioned object as giving you lasting satisfaction, that you're not looking to fulfill your pleasure through some conditioned object, right? You understand that, wow, that ice cream tastes very good, or wow, that chocolate cake tastes really good, or wow, that's a really nice view, or wow, that's a really nice car, those are nice clothes. You'll understand that those things are nice, but you'll understand that, okay, it's not these things that are going to bring me permanent pleasure. That's what right view is, that you have the right view to understand that it's not a conditioned object that is going to give you permanent pleasure. It's not possible for that to occur. So whether you still have those things or not is up to you. Of course, we all have certain objects that are around us that we need in order to sustain our life, but you wouldn't be able to consider any of these things as providing lasting satisfaction, because you understand they are impermanent and you can't form inner feelings based on some conditioned object and therefore get permanent happiness. It's just not possible. And then three, incapable of considering any phenomenon as a self, right? So this is the universal truth of non-self. So here he's basically going through all three universal truths: the universal truth of impermanence, the universal truth of discontentedness, and the universal truth of non-self. That he says, okay, here, if you're accomplished in view, you would understand all three universal truths. Then the fourth one is incapable of doing a grave act that brings immediate results. You're going to see that here in a moment. Some people refer to these as the five heinous crimes, I think it is. So I'll show you guys those here in a moment. So these are certain acts that are going to bring immediate results in your life immediate, grave, unwholesome karma is going to come to you if you do those things. And the Buddha will explain it here in a moment. Number five, incapable of resorting to the belief that purity or enlightenment comes about through superstitious or auspicious acts. This is eliminating that rites, rituals, ceremonies, and worship that your mind understands that you can't do superstitious, auspicious things in order to purify the mind, that you no longer have that belief, that you've seen the wisdom for yourself, that in order to train your mind, in order to experience improved results in your life, you need to cultivate wisdom, that you can't do superstitious and auspicious things in order to get to enlightenment. It's just not possible. So here, that's what the Buddha is saying, that in order to have accomplishment in view, you need to be able to see very clearly that it's wisdom that is going to lead to your enlightenment. And you would gain this through all the various teachings, and particularly dependent origination, which is also a teaching that you need in order to get to the first stage of enlightenment. So by the time somebody gets to accomplishment in view, they would have already deeply understood dependent origination and see that the main hindrance to enlightenment is the ignorance or unknowing of true reality. And it's wisdom, which is the antidote to that. So superstitious, mysterious, auspicious things, those aren't going to actually lead to purity of the mind and enlightenment. Number six, incapable of seeking a person worthy of offerings outside of here. What the Buddha is talking about here is that during his lifetime, there were multiple people that were teaching certain teachings and claiming that it was their teachings that led to enlightenment. But of course, a Buddha knows that it's his teachings that lead to enlightenment, and these other people who are teaching, it's not leading to enlightenment, because a Buddha can see very clearly what they're teaching that is not going to produce enlightenment. So as the Buddha was teaching more and more and more, and more people were developing and getting to enlightenment, and more people in the community could see that it was his teachings that were leading to enlightenment, by the time you get to accomplishment in view, meaning that you've gotten to the first stage of enlightenment, you've had a significant decrease to your discontent feelings, that you've seen this significant improvement to the condition of your mind. And you know it's through his teachings that led you to that. So what the Buddha is saying is that you would be incapable of making an offering to somebody else, because your wisdom would be so deep and so profound that you will have already improved your mind to a certain degree, and you would know that it's his teachings that's leading to that improvement. So there wouldn't be anybody outside of his community that you would be willing to make an offering to, because you know that those teachings aren't leading to enlightenment and that it's his teachings that are leading to enlightenment. So instead, you would make offering to produce merit to the ordained practitioners of his tradition, because you know that his teachings are leading to enlightenment. So this is the first discourse here, and we've got four of these to discuss. So let me know if you guys have any questions here. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So let's go to the next one. The next one is the second discourse. Six cases of incapability by one accomplished in view, second discourse. Monks, there are these six cases of incapability. What six? One accomplished in view is incapable of residing without deep respect and politeness towards the teacher. Two, incapable of residing without deep respect and politeness towards the teachings. Three, incapable of residing without respect and politeness towards the community. Four, incapable of residing without deep respect and politeness toward the training. Five, incapable of resorting to anything that should not be relied upon. Six, incapable of undergoing an eighth existence. These are the six cases of incapability. So again, the Buddha is describing accomplishment in view, and by somebody having gotten to the first stage of enlightenment, they would already be practicing these things. So here, the first three is that somebody would have confirmed confidence in the Buddha, the teachings, and the community, and their teacher here, right? Incapable of residing without deep respect and politeness towards the teacher. The reason why is that if you've gotten to the first stage of enlightenment, you will notice this deep improvement to your mind and to your life, that you will have this significant reduction in discontentedness. And if there's a teacher that has helped you to accomplish that, you would have nothing but respect and politeness towards that person, because you can see the improvement to the condition of your mind. So you would have respect and politeness towards the teacher, towards those teachings that guided you to that, and the community that has helped you to be able to accomplish that. Then the Buddha describes these next three. where he says you would be incapable of residing without deep respect and politeness towards the training. That's the path to enlightenment, the eight factors and the discipline that he describes. You'd be incapable of resorting to anything that should not be relied upon. What he's saying here is that in order for you to get to this first stage of enlightenment, you're going to need to understand how to listen to something or how to read something, and then don't believe it, that you need to independently verify it, that you're not going to operate on assumptions or perceptions, that you're not going to cling to these things, that you're going to go off into the world, and as you hear things and as you understand things, you're going to look for the truth and make sure that anything that you're making decisions about, that you know the truth. Because any decisions you make, it's either going to be wise or unwise, and it's going to produce either wholesome results or unwholesome results. So if you're making decisions based on false truths, that is assumptions or perceptions that you're clinging to, you're going to make unwise decisions and it's going to produce unwholesome results. And you're just producing more unwholesome karma for yourself. But if you penetrate into the truth, and if that means delaying a decision, if that means having follow-up conversations, if that means you need to make a week or two or a month or two or a year or two of investigation before you make any decisions, then so be it. Right? Because you don't have craving. You're not interested in making any decisions on false truths. That would be very unwise. So that's what the Buddha is describing here. Incapable of undergoing an eighth existence. This is because by the time someone's accomplished in view, they're in the first stage of enlightenment. And in that first stage of enlightenment, you will, if you die in that stage, come back to the world no more than seven times. So it's impossible. You're incapable of undergoing an eighth existence. That's what he's describing here. So let me know what questions you guys have on this one. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions here. So now we'll go to the next one. This is the third discourse. Monks, there are these six cases of incapability. What six? One accomplished in view is incapable of depriving his mother of life. Two, incapable of depriving his father of life. Three, incapable of depriving an arahant of life. 4. Incapable of shedding the Tathagata's blood with a mind of hatred. 5. Incapable of creating a division in the community. 6. Incapable of acknowledging another teacher. These are the six cases of incapability. So here, this is the Buddha describing the next discourse. And these here are considered the five heinous crimes. These here are what the Buddha describes as the last one, or the very first one, where you would be incapable of doing any action that would bring grave results, right? So an individual who's gotten to accomplishment in view in the first stage of enlightenment, they would be incapable of depriving their mother or father of life, meaning killing their mother or father, because you would understand that you've gotten to this first stage of enlightenment, your mind has experienced this drastic improvement to the condition of the mind, and it was your mother and father that had the ability for you to then be able to come into this world, into this human life, so that now you can actually get to enlightenment. So you would have nothing but respect and gratitude for your parents that they were able to have this child, which is you, to then be able to now cultivate your mind and train your mind and be able to get to that first stage of enlightenment, and you'll be experiencing the improvement to the condition of your mind. You'd also be incapable of depriving an arahant of life. This is an enlightened being, because by the time you're in the first stage of enlightenment, you would have interacted with some people who were most likely enlightened, and you would understand how important enlightened beings are to the world, that by them being enlightened and sharing teachings, now you're able to get to enlightenment yourself. So there's no way you would ever kill an enlightened being. Incapable of shedding the Tathagata's blood with a mind of hatred, meaning you'd be incapable of killing a Buddha, right? If you understand how important it is for an enlightened being to be in a world, then knowing that there's a Buddha in the world and interacting with the Buddha, you'd be highly incapable of harming a Buddha, because you would know how important it is for that person to be in the world and sharing the teachings to be able to help people to get to enlightenment. Number five here is incapable of creating division in the community. Well, once again, if you've gotten to the first stage of enlightenment, it's been your teacher, it's been the teachings and the community that's helped you accomplish that. And you will be experiencing significant improvement to the condition of your mind. So the last thing you're interested in doing is seeing this community break apart. So you wouldn't be doing things that are going to create division within the community of practitioners where you're learning and growing and developing on the path to enlightenment. You'd be incapable of doing that because you would know how important it is for this community to be together in order to support the continued sharing of the teachings. And then the Buddha says, incapable of acknowledging another teacher. Because once again, if there's a particular teacher that has helped you get to the first stage of enlightenment, experiencing that significant improvement, and you know that that teacher was able to help you do that, and they've done that without charging you any money or asking anything of you or wanting anything from you, you would be incapable of going to another teacher because you will have seen such significant improvement to the condition of your mind, you wouldn't be able to acknowledge another person as your teacher, and you would know that it's this person that's going to help you get to enlightenment because they've already helped you to get to the first stage of enlightenment. Let me know what questions you guys have on this chapter. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. So now we'll go to the fourth discourse of the same type, six cases of incapability by one accomplished in view, fourth discourse. Monks, there are these six cases of incapability. What six? One accomplished in view is, one, incapable of resorting to the view that pleasure and pain are made by oneself. Two, incapable of resorting to the view that pleasure and pain are made by another. Three, incapable of resorting to the view that pleasure and pain are both made by oneself and made by another. Four, incapable of resorting to the view that pleasure and pain are not made by oneself, but have arisen by accident or chance. Five, incapable of resorting to the view that pleasure and pain are not made by another, but have arisen by accident or chance. Six, incapable of resorting to the view that pleasure and pain are made by neither by oneself nor by another, but have arisen by accident or chance. These are the six cases of incapability. For what reason? Because the person accomplished in view has clearly seen causation and causally arisen objects. These are the six cases of incapability. So what he's describing here is that you understand the natural law of karma, of cause and effect, action and result, that you understand this causality, that there needs to be a cause and condition to produce any particular effect or any particular result. And you would be incapable of resorting to the view that discontentedness is made by oneself, made by another, made by both oneself and made by another, that are not made by oneself, but have arisen by accident or chance, that are not made by another, but have arisen by accident or chance, or are made by neither by oneself nor by another, but have arisen by accident or chance. What he's describing here is, what is creating all these discontent feelings, the conditioned feelings? What's causing it? Is it you? Well, no, it can't be you because there is no you. Right? There can't be caused by oneself because there's no self here. What's causing it is craving, desire, attachment. So if you understand that craving, desire, attachment is what's causing all your discontent feelings, and you can't foresee any of these things, that you're incapable of resorting to these views that discontentedness is made by yourself because there is no self. You understand it's craving, desire, attachment that's causing discontentedness. You know that discontentedness isn't caused by another person. That's not possible. That discontentedness are both made by yourself and another person. That's not possible. Incapable of resorting to the view that discontentedness is not made by oneself, but have arisen by accident or chance. No, discontentness isn't arising by accident or chance. It's craving, desire, attachment that's causing it. That if you are not capable of resorting to the view that discontentedness is not made by another, but have arisen by accident or chance, and if you're incapable of resorting to the view that pleasure and pain are made neither by oneself nor by another, but have arisen by accident or chance, then you might actually be practicing this already, this particular discourse. That if you understand that it's craving, desire, attachment that's causing it, then this one, you might already have accomplishment in view. So here, you would have been able to clearly see this causation in this causally arisen objects, that discontentedness is arising based on craving, desire, attachment. That's the cause or condition that is producing it. So let me know what questions you guys have here on this one. This is chapter 18. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions here. So let's move to chapter 19. Chapter 19 is titled Six Benefits in Realizing the Fruit of Stream Entry. So these are the six things that the Buddha is describing are beneficial as a result of getting to the first stage of enlightenment. And I also share this in the retreat that I teach in January, which is to help you get to the first stage of enlightenment. Monks, these are the six benefits in realizing the fruit of stream entry. What six? One is fixed in the wholesome teachings. Two, one is incapable of decline. Three, one's discontentedness is limited. Four, one comes to possess wisdom not shared by others. Five, one has clearly seen causation. Six, one has clearly seen causally arisen objects. These are the six benefits in realizing the fruit of stream entry. Okay, so let me help you understand this here. By the time you get to that first stage of enlightenment, as I've mentioned, there's this significant decrease in your discontentedness. And the Buddha actually is explaining that here too, that there's this significant discontentedness that has been decreased, that it's limited. That's number three. And because of that, you are fixed in the wholesome teachings, meaning you know these are the teachings that are leading to the improvement to the condition of your mind. It's not anything else that you've studied at any other time in your life. It's these teachings of the Buddha. So you're fixed. You know that this collection of teachings is what's going to lead to your enlightenment. You're not enlightened yet. You're only in the first stage of enlightenment, but you're fixed. You know that it's these teachings because you've seen enough progress. One is incapable of decline. By the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, it's not possible for your mind to regress out of that. Up until then, your mind can regress. If you become complacent while you're in the jhanas or prior to the jhanas, your mind will regress backwards. But once you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you've eliminated doubt. Any kind of doubt about the teachings, you've eliminated that. So you know that it's only a matter of continuing to learn, continuing to reflect, continuing to practice, that you will get to enlightenment. So you're incapable of declining and regressing backwards by the time you get to that first stage of enlightenment. Your discontentedness has significantly reduced. It's a mere fraction of what it once was. One comes to possess wisdom not shared by others. That certain wisdom that you've developed in order to get to that first stage of enlightenment, other people don't understand it. And you should never hold this out through conceit or arrogance, but instead just understand that things that are very simple and very easy for you, other people aren't going to understand that. So you're going to need to be humble because of this wisdom that you have. And as you walk around, you're going to see people struggling with the most simplest of things, but yet it comes so easy for you. So you're going to have certain wisdom that other people don't share. And you're going to need to be very humble and very selective about how you share that. And if you just rushed in and kind of shared it with people without them asking or requesting, this would be the arrogance or the ego in the mind. So you're going to need to restrain your mind. If you have craving to share, you're going to need to restrain the mind and only share selectively. Five, one has clearly seen causation. What the Buddha is talking about here is the natural law of karma, that you've clearly seen that by the time you got to the first stage of enlightenment, that you can clearly see this natural law. You're still developing, you still haven't fully implemented all the teachings, but you've clearly seen it and you understand it. And then the sixth one is, one has clearly seen causally arisen objects, meaning that you understand the dependent origination. This is the highest, most ultimate truth of the teachings of the Buddha, that there's these objects that one leads to the next. So for example, ignorance leads to volitional formations, and then volitional formations leads to consciousness. Consciousness and continuing on and on and on and on, that you would have studied dependent origination, which I teach in this program and others, where you can understand it and you would have clearly been able to penetrate that and understand it in order to get to the first stage of enlightenment. So this is what the Buddha is saying are the six benefits of having gotten to the first stage of enlightenment. And one of the things that I will postscript here is that by the time you get to the first stage of enlightenment, you will have all the wisdom that you need in order to make your way to enlightenment. You won't actually have the ability to go off on your own at that point. Of course, you are on your own. It's your own independent journey. You're still going to need guidance from a teacher. But in terms of all the teachings that you would need, you will have been exposed to everything by that point. That there isn't anything that's going to pop up after that and be like, aha, you didn't know about this. Look at that. It's kind of like if you were going to make your way to Mount Everest, that you're at base camp and you've got all the equipment. You've got all the wisdom, all the equipment, all the tools, all the techniques. You haven't gotten to the summit yet, but you've got everything that you need. You're prepared to get to the summit. And you've done all your preliminary work. You just haven't made your way to the summit yet. You're there with all the tools, techniques, and equipment. And you've had to do a lot of work in order just to get to the base camp of Mount Everest. But you have everything you need to get to the summit. It's the same thing that getting to enlightenment, you've got everything you need at the first stage of enlightenment. You haven't gotten to enlightenment yet, and you're still going to need help. Just like those hikers, they need help from base camp to the summit. They still need help, but they've got all the equipment that they need. So you'll have all the tools and all the techniques, and you're still working with those in order to refine the mind, but there's nothing that's kind of left out, right? You'll have already been exposed to everything by that time. So this is chapter 19. These are the six benefits of realizing the fruit of stream entry, which is the first stage of enlightenment. Let me know what questions you guys have here. Okay, I'm not seeing any questions. So let's go to the last chapter for today. This is chapter 20. This one's titled Three Wrong Views About Sectarian Tenets That a Noble Disciple Must Abandon. Monks, there are these three sectarian tenets which, when questioned, interrogated, and cross-examined by the wise, and taken to their conclusion, will eventuate in non-action. What he's saying is that there's these three things that if you examine them and you investigate them, that your conclusion is that these things aren't true. Okay? What are the three? One, there are monks, some ascetics and Brahmins, who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever this person experiences, whether pleasure, pain, or neither pain nor pleasure, all that is caused by what was done in the past. Two, there are other ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine in view as this. Whatever this person experiences, whether pleasure, pain, or neither pain nor pleasure, all that is caused by God's creative activity. Three, and there are still other ascetics and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine in view as this. Whatever this person experiences, whether pleasure, pain, or neither pain nor pleasure, all that occurs without a cause or condition. Okay, and then beyond this, the Buddha is just expanding each one of these in detail, which I'm not actually going to read, but you guys can read these because they're here in the book and they're available for you. But we'll just work with what is here at the top because the Buddha is summarizing this. What he's saying in this first one is that if you understand the wisdom of the path to enlightenment, that you will have understood that the discontentedness that you experience, the pleasure, pain, neither pain nor pleasure, those discontent feelings, those conditional feelings, that you will not be able to get to a point where you would think that all of that is caused by what you have experienced in the past. Sometimes this is what people think. I see this oftentimes in places like Sri Lanka. They will think that whatever they're experiencing today, it's because of everything in their past life. Everything in their past life, they can't change anything about what it is that they're experiencing right now because everything that they're experiencing now is all based on their past lives. This is not true. And if you read the teachings of the Buddha, he explains to you that this isn't actually true. Then the second one, he's saying, okay, there's people out there that believe that these discontent feelings you experience, the conditioned pleasant feelings, painful feeling, and neither painful nor pleasant, that everything you experience in life is caused by God's creative activity, that God's the one who's controlling the world. And that's why you're experiencing all these difficulties. But this isn't true either, right? But there's a lot of people who actually think that way. And this is going to hinder them from being able to get to enlightenment. And then the third one that he's talking about here is that these discontent feelings, that all of this is caused without a cause or condition, that there's no rhyme or reason why the discontentedness is arising. And the Buddha ultimately gets to the point where he says, this isn't true either, right? And you need to be able to see that through studying his teachings. You'll be able to see through learning, reflecting to independently verify and practice that there is a causing condition. It's called craving, desire, attachment. That's what's causing the discontent feelings. It's not other people. And you can see very clearly that it's not God that's producing certain results in your life, either wholesome or unwholesome. It's not God who's doing that. It's your own decisions that are producing that. And you can also see that what you're experiencing in life now isn't based on everything that's happened in the past, right? There are certain things in our past that are being experienced now, certain decisions that we made in the past that are producing certain results now, but everything you're experiencing right now isn't based on your past lives, right? Or even past things. So you need to be able to see that you have the control, you have the ability to make improvements to your life. If you didn't have any other view than that, then it's a defeating perspective. It's sabotaging the mind. If you didn't understand that everything you experience is being caused by your own decisions, and you have the ability to cultivate wisdom, make better decisions, and experience improved results, that's what you're going for. You need to be able to see that very clearly. But what the unenlightened mind will tend to do is it blames other people for what you're experiencing. And part of that is because of the ego. But the biggest part of that is the lack of wisdom, right? So as long as an individual thinks that everything you're experiencing is from the past or from God or without a cause and condition, there's no reason for you to do any work right now in this life because you're just locked in and everything that you're experiencing is fate or it's destiny. This isn't actually true. What you're experiencing is a result of the decisions that you're making. And the decisions you're making are based on your wisdom or your lack of wisdom. So the more wisdom that you have, you'll make wiser and wiser choices that then produce more and more wholesome results in your life. So this is what the Buddha is teaching here in chapter 20. So let me know if you guys have any questions here. Okay. I'm not seeing any questions anywhere. So what I'll do then is just thank all of you guys for attending today's class and remind you that next week we're going to be in volume 12, chapters 21 through 30. And this is each Saturday, our Polycanon and English study group, where I do this on Saturday morning at 9 a.m. and Saturday evening at 9 p.m. And depending on your time zone, that might be Friday evening and Saturday morning, depending on where you're at. So you're welcome to tune in live to our classes, or you're welcome to watch the replays on our YouTube channel, Facebook group, or in our podcast. So we're going to be going through the rest of these books, and we're going to actually be finishing up this program at the end of July. And then from there, we'll be continuing forward and restarting from the very beginning. Tomorrow in our group learning program, which is great as a foundational program, we're going to be teaching the 10 fetters, which are those 10 pollutions. I'm going to be introducing you to all of those and helping you understand a bit about them and a little bit about how to eradicate each one, and the 4 stages of enlightenment. I'll be discussing that with you as well. And then on Wednesday, I'm going to be starting a 4-part series on loving kindness meditation to help students build up their loving kindness meditation practice. So if you'd like to attend any of these classes or courses, you're welcome to do that. On Monday, this Monday, I'm going to be starting a course titled Harmony in Relationships. This is going to be Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., where you're going to be learning about how to produce harmony in your relationships through learning the teachings of the Buddha that are going to be able to help you to be able to develop these harmonious relationships. So thank you all for joining. You're always welcome to attend any and all of these classes that I share. Anytime that you need help, feel free to reach out through asking questions in class, through sending a private message, through you can schedule personal guidance with me, or you can post in our Facebook group and you're able to ask questions there and I'll be able to help you. So thank you so much for attending. Thank you for listening to the replay, and we'll see you guys in a future class. Have a very lovely and wonderful rest of your day. Sawadee ka.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To provide support for this podcast, visit patreon.com/supportbuddha. To access more teachings, visit buddhadailywisdom.com. There, you will discover a full range of courses, retreats, and online resources to assist you on the path to enlightenment. Remember, to establish a daily, consistent meditation practice, along with learning and practicing these teachings, a well-developed meditation practice is the foundation in which to train the mind to attain enlightenment.